path. Because it was round one of the SFL season, the year I didn't play. And we went to just watch the footy.
Yeah.
At 2 p.m, finished up about 5 a.m. Had nowhere to go. Slept in the park. Went to breakfast that day covered in wood chips.
That's it. Caught the cab past my house to the park.
Yeah.
So you could get...
Just didn't want to disturb it.
What was waiting for you at the park?
Nothing.
Just a place to be.
Didn't have... My phone was flat and I hadn't pre-arranged anything. I didn't want to go and disrupt anyone.
Yeah.
So I
pissed thought, cognitive reasoning.
What's the safest park in Hobart? South Hobart.
What is
the
safest?
It would be, actually. Is that all... West Hobart Park, maybe?
The train park.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's quite central, though.
South Hobart's a little bit outlying. People... There's no thoroughfare...
But you could freeze to death under the mountain.
Well, it's quite cold, isn't it? Yeah. That's what I was thinking about. I was like, it was this time of year. I did that. Wandered back down. Fonty drove past me in the morning. didn't pick me up.
God, what a mate he is.
I was terrified that I'd go to sleep for too long and wake up and there'd be kids in the park.
Patron.
Oh, imagine that.
Yeah. Did any patron see you?
Nah, wake up about... Got a good couple of hours in, woke up about 7.
Seize the day.
Got back down to the car park to get the car out.
The cable car wasn't contentious, so there was no protesters in the morning.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Don't give them anything else to protest about. No sleeping in parks. Hobart's homeless problem.
Yeah. Don't give them another
one. See another victim. Yeah. No, actually, I'm just a dickhead.
Yeah. Finally, you're a Liberal government.
They're all getting around revved.
Like, look at this dedication. Yeah. Slept here the night. Yeah. Welcome to episode 25, Feeding of Freaks. Deep into season 2 now, so.
Deep?
Deep? Oh, no, still no. Shallow.
Scratching the surface.
It's like the Humanville Lions on Saturday.
Don't be so harsh. Bit to work on, Rev.
That's good.
What are we aiming episode-wise for the season?
20.
20 to 25. Yeah.
Yeah.
Sounds good.
Sounds reasonable.
Yeah.
Fuck off for 3 months again like we just did recently.
Yeah, have a convenient season 3 launch.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Just whenever the wheels fall off again, that's what we'll call it, won't we? Season 2.
Absolutely. Let's not commit to anything. It's like an HBO thing. We could just run it out as long as we want and call it season... No, I don't know. We'll figure it out.
I do want to apologise to two of our listeners. They sent me a Snapchat of them waiting for the episodes to come out. And she goes, they said they were going to get guests on. They said they were going to have people come on next week and have a guest when Tom's away. One of them's away.
We had a guest. A guest.
That was 5 months from...
That was in season. That was nothing to do with anyone being away.
Oh, look, we honour our promises, though.
No, we don't. We've got a bad track record of not...
The gift pack's in the mail, isn't it?
No. You're waiting for it.
We should do that, though. That'd be funny.
Yeah.
All right, so part 2 of the Whiskey A Go-Go Massacre.
Where did we leave off, Red?
I believe we just left you after the fire itself. And I think the last little bit of information we left you with was about how the Eagle Bolton, probably our favourite character. Our favourite character, would we agree?
Ever.
No, of the last episode. Oh,
yeah, or, I don't know. I'm waiting to see what Doug does. Yeah.
So, to summarise last time, we gave you a bit of a backstory on, I suppose, Fortitude Valley around the time and really dived into the story of John Stewart, who we discovered to be a clean maniac out of Brisbane, who had a decorated criminal career and had been basically ranting and raving his way around Brisbane for some time, prophesying about 2 fires that would occur. And obviously we've just left you off after the second of those fires. And we'd also talked about how his mouthpiece, Brian the Eagle Bolton, had failed to keep an appointment with him at the Whiskey A Go-Go to once again detail about the plan that John Stewart wasn't involved in that was being hatched around firebombing the whiskey.
He was basically running around town saying, this is going to happen. It's not going to be me. I'm not going to be there. It's not me. But this is exactly what's going to happen to the time, wasn't it, Rev? Mm. He was pretty accurate with everything. There was going to be an empty nightclub and then one filled with patrons.
Well, the one thing he wasn't quite on was the time frames, which was why the Eagle wasn't too fussed about the fact he failed to keep the appointment, because John had been saying it would happen a fair bit off in the future. But as we now know, the firebombing had occurred. So
the Eagle wasn't there.
No, the Eagle was asleep. And as we also heard, a sleeping Brian was better than a drinking Brian.
Good family motto.
It's the only positive on the evening.
Yeah, don't wake him up.
So just before I pick back up with John and his mate Doug, who I'm sure we're all anxious to find out more about.
You call him Doug?
he used to be called Doug and only Doug.
He dared add anything to that.
So I just want to give some information around the fire itself. So sadly, 15 people did pass away and another 40 were injured. So within 60 seconds, the visibility within the club was so poor that there basically was no visibility at all. The owners of the club, the Littles, had neglected to replace a faulty exit sign that was picked up during a fire compliance check. So no lit exit sign, which probably take for granted. You see the flashing or the bright green exit signs everywhere. And obviously when there's a fire around, that would be useful. But that wasn't the case.
The Little Brothers.
Little Brothers. And they had little regard for fire safety. So they were, the clientele of the club were entirely reliant on the staff of the place to direct them to the fire exit. It was a bit of a difficult floor plan. You can imagine if you're in a bar or a club, you're probably not going to note where all the exits are and know exactly how to find it in the dark.
But imagine what you do when you go into a club. Just
I'm just thinking about the average person.
Yeah, just make sure there's a fire extinguisher, there's an alarm.
I plan out my, I'm always planning out my exit.
I've seen you with your little checklist when you walk in. Yeah,
absolutely. I remember.
Pull the pad out.
Yep. So John Bell, who was the head bouncer, stood basically at the top of the stairs and shouted and directed people down where the doorman, Francis Longhurst, had been able to unlock the door to the side alley, which was very fortunate because it was a ridiculous setup that only a staff member could possibly have known how to work. It wasn't like your typical fire escape doors where you push on the bar and it lets you out. They had a complex lock, but Francis was able to open that up.
Doorman, what do they do?
I think they're a poor man's bouncer.
Yeah, I was wondering that. What's the difference between the bounce and the door?
I think Francis let people in and John kept people out.
Right.
So a lot of the people in the inside were able to get out that way, but the exit itself was actually obstructed by a trolley and some cartons that had been removed recently for the fire survey and put back by the Little Brothers.
This all sounds like a huge hindsight list of what we, the safety and compliances now that we have in basically every commercial building.
Mm.
Make sure the exits are clear. Mm. Make sure the exit signs lit up. Make sure it's ease of access and there's more than two ways out of a building.
Yeah.
It's just an absolute list of
scary
chaos.
Parallels to the Luna Park ghost train.
Yeah, very similar.
Well, actually, we had a real fire theme of late.
Yeah. We have, actually. Yeah. But yeah, maintenance was an issue there. Rev, I'm sure you listen to it now, that great episode that...
Yeah. By the time the listeners listen to this, I will have, but it hasn't actually come out yet.
Okay, so. Just lie to us. Just lie to us and say
yeah, it's great.
Don't break the illusion.
It's interesting that they had recently had a fire compliance check, because you can imagine that the emphasis would have been a bit higher on this after this particular incident. But the other thing I find amazing is, whilst John Stewart was obviously a maniac that people didn't take completely seriously, considering that he had been running around telling everyone about how the place was about to be firebombed, I would have thought that would have maybe led to a little bit more of a thorough approach to fire safety at the time.
You'd think so. If you hear there's a burglar around the town, I'm pretty sure everyone goes and checks their window locks, door locks, and makes sure everything's sealed up. So,
yeah,
I guess that just shows people didn't take him seriously.
No, no, it's a theme we'll come back to again in the episode.
So no fire exits, Rev?
Oh. There was just the one. Yeah,
it was just the one.
Yeah, that was pretty difficult to access. So that was basically the exit for most of the people. There were also patrons which actually included the members of the bands, the Deltones and Trinity, who were playing that night, who smashed windows and jumped out onto neighbouring roofs. There was an off-duty police officer, Hunter Nickel, great name, who grabbed a disoriented young lady and dragged her through a broken window.
Sounds brutal.
Oh, better than the window. Alternative. All the glass had been cleared out. She didn't get scraped across the glass. Sorry, I should have said cleared out space rather than broken window.
Good work by Hunter Nickel.
Yes, very good. And many of the people inside were disoriented and incapacitated, and in the confusion and owing to the poor fire plan, were unable to escape, unfortunately. So,
recipe for disaster, really, isn't it?
Oh, I think we saw the disaster unfolding there.
Mm.
Stu, pretty graphic stuff.
Absolutely. Mm. So we'll jump back to our maniac, John Stewart.
Our maniac. Fondly referencing.
Do we want to take ownership of it? To the maniac. So John was spotted later that morning emptying the apartment that he and Doug had rented under the name John Trouts, which we discussed that John liked to run by.
A-U-T or O-U-T?
A-U-T-S. Okay. Yeah, Stuart backwards.
Yep.
Very clever.
Yeah, smart man. Have we ever come across anyone who had a good fake name?
Not yet. No.
Simon Cadwell, if you really throw back to that episode, he had some good ones.
Simon Cartwheel.
Some of those might not have been true, to be honest.
Nah, fabricated for the
bit of
the
pepper on those.
So they'd only taken out the lease 4 days earlier, but they evacuated that morning, which I think we can all agree is very odd behaviour.
4 days?
John...
They do that those kind of leases? just on the place for 4 days?
It was a precursor to Airbnb.
Yeah.
He then met up with his police contact, Basil Hicks, and a solicitor, because obviously he knew that he was going to get some scrutiny. He'd been ranting and raving for months, so only natural. And he was then taken into custody. He was immediately marked as wanted, went into custody and was questioned for 9 hours. So in this interview, he stuck to his story and stated that and named the three men who he believed were responsible as Les, Ross and Roger the Dodger.
And how do they look, Rev?
They looked like they were Mexican and they all had seedy moustaches. So
I wish that was us.
One could be Les. Yeah.
One Rog.
I'm letting the troops down. You guys are sporting a bit of beard at the moment, a bit of facial hair.
And jeez, we're not far away.
Clean cut stew.
Roger the Dodger.
So,
can we learn any more about these guys?
No, because I don't believe that they existed. We'll go a little bit further into that. So,
imagine that. Who were they? Oh, it was three. It was Les, Ross, and Roger the Dodger.
Yeah, Roger the Dodger.
Yeah.
So we discussed last episode that he was basically trying to say that this plot was being hatched by three young crazy criminals from Sydney, which there are actually some accounts that confirm people that match this description being around Fortitude Valley at the time. I think...
your description here.
Mexican, with all Mexican looking, with moustaches. Yeah.
There's at least three of them.
Three of them, spotted and placed in Fortitude Valley by, I believe, what was his name? The bouncer that he was with. Alf Quick.
Alf Quick.
So Alf Quick, Alfred Quick actually did confirm seeing similar people. And if we remember, John made a point of staying in his company up until just beyond when the fire itself had broken out.
And that's where he went to the phone box, made the call to check the time.
Yeah. So there was a little bit of credibility to the story, but it wasn't enough to avert the suspicions of John's own brother, Daniel. Later on, with other guests present at the house, Doug and John arrived at Daniel's home, behaving in a typically odd and erratic manner. Daniel proceeded to call the police and inform them he knew where the instigators of the Whiskey A Go-Go fire were. He then started a fight with his dinner guest in an incident pre-planned with detectives, knowing that John would react with violence. The police were able to attend and detain him for threatening them with a knife, and Doug swiftly got away.
So it was a setup.
Wow. It was all a setup from Daniel with the police. They planned it over the phone very quickly, knowing that...
Yeah, that was all done on the spot.
Mm, so knowing that they couldn't bring John in based on the fire because they had nothing but circumstantial evidence at the time, they needed something to bring him in on. So Daniel started a fight. John got involved, as was pretty well within his character, and he was detained for that. So
who did John fight, Daniel, or the other dinner guest?
The other dinner guest. The other dinner guest, I'm not sure he was as willing a participant as he arguably should have been for this. I feel like he should have been signing some sort of waiver. John being a bit of a maniac and Daniel too, to a degree.
Police have thrown him under the bus.
I wonder what the dinner conversation was to start that fight.
Yeah.
Talking about politics at the time and it really gets him riled up.
But then Daniel was still abusing everyone even after John left.
Keep it going. Sacrifice the friendship.
But Doug swiftly got away. But that wasn't the last that Daniel Stewart had seen of him. He, in fact, popped back up a few days later. But the police had the house under surveillance and immediately popped straight back up to, once again, apprehend Doug.
They didn't arrest?
No, they couldn't get in the first time, though. They got John... So John pulled a knife on the police in the brawl that ensued the fight started by Daniel. But yep. Doug used the distraction of that commotion to get out the back door and run away.
Clever.
So he popped back up to the house, which, as I mentioned, was under surveillance and was immediately greeted by police. But he did again get away. Slippery customer, Doug. Hmm. But the police managed to obtain Doug's passport, which Daniel Stewart had been hiding on behalf of John and had tipped off the police as to its whereabouts and found that he wasn't actually Doug.
What was his name?
James Finch.
Oh,
Finchy.
Is it James Bond?
No. James Finch. So James Finch had migrated to Australia in 1954 after a particularly rough upbringing in the UK. He was an extremely violent and well-known firebug and immediately fell in with a criminal element as soon as he was old enough, basically, much like some of the other characters we've covered in this book.
Much known as a firebug, and John Stewart decides to hang around with a well-known firebug.
Yeah, so, and not only that, bring him into the country under a false passport.
Oh, no.
Doug.
So their relationship was struck up in 1965 whilst in detention. Their relationship centred around crime. So this is after Finch came out in 1954 when he was only a kid.
Right.
So he was Finch was jailed in 1965 for the shooting of another criminal figure, which he later alleged was actually perpetrated by John Stewart. And he then spent 7 years in prison before being released and deported back to England. John brought him back out here on a false passport about 8 days prior to the Whiskey A Go Go fire.
Mm-hmm.
So a short time after, Finch was apprehended at the Jindalee shopping complex. And upon capture, he basically broke down and spilled the beans. So Detective Sergeant Atkinson asked if he was James Richard Finch. And he replied, no, Doug Jones. I only arrived in this country from England 10 days ago. Atkinson responded, I recognise you from the photograph in your passport, which you left in the home of Daniel Stewart. I know that your name is James Richard Finch. Why did you run away from Dan Stewart's home last night and again this morning when police arrived? Wouldn't you if you'd done what I've done? Kill me now. Go on, kill me. I deserve it. After some more questioning from Atkinson, he responded with, shoot me. Put me out of my misery. I should have run and made you shoot me. Go on, shoot me.
Oh, no.
I was obviously getting quite hysterical. He said, I saw you get Johnny Stewart last night from his brother's place. Johnny paid my way out from England a fortnight ago, and he got me mixed up with that fire, and now there are 15 dead. I nearly died when he told me last Thursday morning. We didn't mean to kill those 15. You must believe me. I've been hiding in the bush over there since. The ants nearly ate me, and the kangaroos attacked me, and I hurt my heel on a stump getting away from them. What relevance that bears, only James could tell us.
Nature's turned against him.
And then Atkinson seemed to sympathise. What have you been living on in the bush? Tin stuff. There's still some in my gear at Johnny's brother's place.
That's what he's going back for.
Canned veggies.
Come on and we'll get you to Johnny's brother's place. They're obviously deeply concerned about the canned stuff. Tin stuff, rather.
Yeah, far out.
As they walked to the police car, Finch still didn't stop. God, why did you have to catch me? It would be easier for me to die. Go on, shoot me. Blow my brains out.
Far out. Check if they never caught him, he'd still be in the bush.
Living on tin stuff.
Sounds like an Australian horror story with the kangaroos and the ants.
And what about his heel?
Oh, no, the heel. Oh.
Didn't probably garner much sympathy, I wouldn't have thought. Hurt heel.
Attacked by the kangaroos.
The only sympathy I've got is if he's reacting that strangely, do you think it's because he's scared of the repercussions of other people potentially involved, Brett?
I don't know, maybe.
Or is it genuine remorse from killing 15 people?
It's interesting. Yeah, I think it actually is genuine remorse. He probably, we'll see as we follow the rest of this case, he did seem to be quite genuine in that. I don't believe he ever killed anyone else.
Right.
Which I suppose is as good a indicator of genuine remorse as we're likely to find.
But he did light other fires. Is that what you said?
He was a firebug.
He was well known as a child to be a firebug.
Right.
Yeah. So.
So what was
John liked his CV and said.
What was the motivation for Finch jumping in on this?
Well, we might get into that in a moment. So when he was taken to the police station and questioned, he gave a bit more of a detailed account there, Tom, about why this terrible mission was carried out. He said, it was not intended to be this way. It was intended to intimidate them so as Johnny could get what he wanted. He stated it was all Johnny's idea and that plan was hatched via letters between he and where John was telling Finch of his business standing over nightclubs in Brisbane.
Mm, sure.
So basically the arrangement was that John Stewart would pay for his fare to get out to Australia. He wanted him out there really badly to give the clubs a shake up. He didn't give any really good insight as to why he was imported, but he did drop this gem that John had told him that he'd studied psychology and that he had worked out a plan to fool you coppers and set himself up with a perfect alibi. So that's what we've been documenting over the last couple of months with the Eagle in tow. That was John's psychologically trained perfect alibi.
That was his rock solid get out of jail free
card. He's a psychologist.
Good on him.
Yeah.
Gave further details, which basically were obviously completely damning to he and John Stewart. So he obviously, this testimony was quite damning to both Finch and Stewart. And Stewart was soon dragged in to respond basically to the claims that Finch had made. And he didn't really do anything to dissuade the police that he was guilty. In fact, he really just tried to throw Finch under the bus and said that he himself shouldn't be guilty because Finch was the one that lit it. So all that psychological training didn't help him under the fierce interrogation of the local police.
All the technical aspects of law that you can be involved in something and be guilty with it, even if you don't light the match.
He was a psychologist, not a lawyer, though.
Oh, yeah, sorry, yeah. That's his profession.
So did Stewart know that people were going to be in the nightclub? Obviously, Finch.
Yeah, and I suppose if we think about the whole setup that he was trying to put together, he was basically saying that the people that were going to portray, that were going to complete the act, were not afraid to kill people and were in fact intending to try to raise the right amount of fear. So a lot of the behaviour that's reported from them over the few days between the fire and the arrest would indicate that they probably didn't intend to kill that many people, and it probably took off a little bit faster than they intended, and I don't think they'd factored in any of the whiskey a go-go sloppy fire plan.
Sure.
But they certainly were aware of the fact that it could well result in deaths. So obviously this progressed then to the trial, and that was a bit of a bizarre display with a who's who of the Sydney and Brisbane underworld basically being dragged into the court each day. John Stewart actually swallowed a massive amount of wire in an attempt to delay the trial.
He just said he was sick.
Yeah, and or be classed as insane, which had been his MO previously.
How much is a massive amount?
I think he was swallowing a fair big roll every day, wasn't he? He was basically telling them that his stomach was going to fill up with wire if they didn't do something. He was just going back into his standard sort of
God, that is
process
extreme.
Of really carrying on and trying to pretend that he was getting a rough trot. So
a similar response to Finch, though. Finch is like, just shoot me now, get it over with. I don't want to go through with, you know, going to jail or this whole process. It's quite similar.
Yeah, and I think a lot of it was based around his belief that if he was not able to attend, he wasn't able to attend, that the trial couldn't proceed. But as with some of his prior training in psychology, he had not mastered law either, as the trial was able to and did proceed without him, which I reckon that everyone in the courtroom was very happy about that. I don't imagine he would have been particularly quiet in the dock. So obviously they were found guilty and convicted of the crime and sentenced to, I think, a 20-year sentence, somewhere around that vicinity. I couldn't actually get clear detail on that.
20-year sentence?
Yeah.
Is he out?
Well, no, because he passed away in prison after a characteristically eventful time in there. Right. He at one point broke out onto a cell block roof and staged a bizarre 52-hour process where he basically just went berserk, smashed lights all around the complex with bricks.
He wrote something on the roof as well, Rev.
So, yes, he did. He wrote on the roof, "Innocent victims of police verbal F and S." So, F&S, Finch and Stewart. So, and they did stick to that story that they were the victims of a police verbal. And
what gave that story so much? Where were they coming from there?
He did it over and over again. And their real claim is around the fact they never signed their confessions, which we'll come to a bit later. So, two men convicted of the crime. 15 counts of... Well, one count of murder, actually. Similar to what we saw in the Eric Cook case, they just took the one murder. So, and they were both sentenced to 25 years in prison. So, and then after, as we mentioned, his bizarre stint in prison, John Stewart died of a heart infection in late January 1979. So, roughly nearly seven years into his sentence. So,
open and shut case.
Open and shut case. Or was it? Was it really that simple?
Don't think it is with the Sydney and Queensland underground crime world.
No, so I'm going to present a couple of alternative theories, and these are very well put together by Jeff Plunkett in his book, The Whiskey A Go Go Massacre, which, as we mentioned in episode one, we're taking most of the research here. So conspiracy theories basically were abound around this case from the minute that it occurred, and there are a lot of stories that got around Brisbane and crime, amongst the crime
Circles,
yeah. And a lot of them based around it being part of an insurance job, and that Stuart and Finch were innocent completely. But one that really got a lot of traction was around the whole attack being part of a larger gang operation, specifically by a gang of LSD addicted youths that the journalist William Stokes, who we'll detail a little bit more in a moment, termed the Clockwork Orange Gang, and that's what they sort of knew themselves as.
Well, that's everyone else in the prison referenced them as the Clockwork Orange Gang, but they apparently never saw themselves as an organised gang.
Okay.
Yeah, and they never apparently called themselves that. Everyone knew them as the Clockwork Orange Gang because of their LSD addiction.
What was their deal? They just take LSD and go crazy.
Carry on.
Yeah, absolute maniacs.
I'm sure most people have heard of, seen, read A Clockwork Orange. Obviously, wildly antisocial behaviour. So, as I mentioned, that story was first put forward by journalist William Stokes. So his accusations implicated Thomas Hamilton, Peter Hall, Keith Meredith, the Mouse Man, Billy McCulkin, who we'll all remember from episode one, had a mouse tattooed on his dick.
Mouse in his pants, except sometimes a rat.
Yes, very, very right.
Everyone wants that comparison with their penis, isn't it?
Well, maybe just a slightly bigger mouse. Gary Dubois and Vincent O'Dempsey, who we're about to get to know a bit better in a few episodes time, Stu, because I think you're going to do one centred around the man himself.
Yeah, I was doing a bit of research with you, Reb, and started to scratch the surface of our Vincent O'Dempsey and realised that there's a much bigger story to be told here. So I've dug a bit deeper, and yeah, in a couple of episodes' time, I'll present you with his full story, but this will be a good touching on point and to see the connections of these two worlds.
Yeah, so
we're not going to be able to get away from these freaks just yet. Is the Mouse Man going to be back?
Yes, he will be. Okay. Yeah, he's connected to this story.
So I'm not going to go too much into the backstory of Vincent O'Dempsey because I'm going to save that for you, Stu. But so Stokes' allegations stem from a discussion he had with Hamilton where he detailed his involvement in the Torino's fire, which I'm sure you'll cover off in greater detail for us as well, Stu. Hamilton also implicated Hall and Meredith, stating that it was an insurance job and they pocketed $500 for it. And Stokes dug a bit further on this one and found that Dubois was also involved and that it was all orchestrated by O'Dempsey, who was allegedly in close association with crooked cop Tony Murphy. So starting to see a few elements build into this one.
It seems a bit more organised, Reverend, than we initially thought. It
certainly does. And
you can see the sort of dynamics too of the more powerful people in this group that start to emerge.
Yeah, and we do also know that it was later found that there was a lot of corruption around in politics and in the police system at that time that were allowing organised crime to flourish basically unchecked and often with the aid and abetment of the police.
Obviously some sacrifices there need to be made on behalf of the organised crime. Where do our boys fit into this?
So it's also noted that our guys that are now in jail were convicted on very little hard evidence. A lot of it was circumstantial and a lot of it was very reliant on their own declarations of guilt. And it will surprise no one to hear the name Roger Rogerson involved. So Roger Rogerson, probably Australia's most famous crooked cop, I would say, currently in jail for the murder of a Sydney youth, Jamie Gow, as part of his long association with organised crime. And he later confirmed that Finch's confession in particular was beaten out of him. And even after it was beaten out of him, he still refused to sign the confession, and that it was in fact signed by Rogerson himself.
Forged it.
Yeah. So
I just said Rogerson.
Roger the Dodger.
Here we go. Next command.
A little stick on the start.
So I think we can pretty clearly draw the motivations behind that. Knowing that there was a few of their own that might be at risk of being implicated here, the police wanted a quick, simple conviction, get the two low-hanging candidates of the group out of the way and move on without pulling in their mates.
Further evidence with that, with his confession, Finch's confession, wasn't there a speech pathologist that compared it with the way he spoke and the way it was written and said that cannot have come from Finch
well? I don't even know if it needed to go to a speech pathologist. I think it was just anyone who'd ever heard him speak versus the way the letter was written. He was a proper Cockney geezer, and the well, language in the letter was very well written and not something he would do. So
yeah, it's always nice when it's backed up by a professional.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So we'll come back to this point because my theory is probably a little bit between where we've got to here. So again, Stu, as I mentioned, don't want to steal too much of your thunder, but Dempsey in particular is a notably bad character, hence he commands his own episode.
A massive understatement.
Yes.
I'll give a little hint, Tom. His nickname is the Angel of Death.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, so.
So he met Dubois in jail in 1964 and they remained close ever after that. And as we've sort of heard through the story of John Stewart, characters like McCulkin were all, they all sort of mingled in together, as you can imagine, you know, criminals gravitate together or...
Oh, they've got similar interests, yeah, you know. Absolutely. They can, what did you get up to on the weekend? Oh, yeah, it's lit a club on fire. Yeah. What did you get up to? Yeah, or belted someone.
Yeah, killed someone.
Yeah.
So Jeff Plunkett does basically sit around this point as being the true version of events. So he claims that the gang, in fact, did exist and consisted of the five we mentioned earlier, plus Stewart and Finch, and that both the firebombings were organised by McCulkin and O'Dempsey, so they were the ringleaders of this group.
Yeah.
What was the grand plan? Where were they angling here?
Was basically, as we've covered along with John Stewart, it was to establish a protection racket, as John Stewart ranted and mm-hmm. raved, and tried to basically implicate other criminals like Lenny McPherson and basically people from Sydney into it, so that attempting to establish an alibi, but also attempting to establish some guilt on other parties, which, despite his strong background in psychology, he was unable to do convincingly.
I wonder what his cohorts thought of the way he went about, you know, spruiking the fear, but also trying to keep himself with an alibi and getting himself in the clear. Do you reckon they were all on board with that tactic?
It seems a bit strange. It's one of the things that comes up a lot in reading this is that people are surprised that John Stewart was involved because he was so erratic and so hard to control. And that feeds into my personal and also Jeff Plunkett's doubt of the fact that police were intimately involved with it, because they wouldn't have allowed themselves to be involved with someone as erratic as John Stewart.
Such a risky character.
Yeah, so that's...
And as well as professional criminals as well, do you reckon they kept him at an arm's length because he was so unreliable?
Yeah.
And hence they were willing to throw him under the bus?
Yeah, I think that's probably more why his role was why he was allowed to be in this, because he was such an easy fall guy.
Yeah, and absolutely.
Despite his efforts to, I suppose, establish an alibi, they knew he was never going to be able to do it convincingly. So as I just alluded to, Plunkett doesn't believe that there was direct police involvement, more so that it was likely that they had good relationships with O'Dempsey and McCulkin, and they were known to be informants, so that's fact, and that they were just trying to help protect their, I suppose, assets and relationships with these guys. So hence the quick convictions and moving on. But it is a bit troubling when you consider, and we'll be able to recap this more conclusively after your episode, Stu, that they would be happy to ally with such a evil character as Vincent O'Dempsey and keep him out of jail.
Yeah. That is scary, the corruption and the amount of power and influence that Vincent had at the time. That'll be really interesting to explore. I don't want to give it away, I nearly did, but yeah, it's a very interesting story that he's got behind him.
Yes. So, interestingly, on a bit of an aside, Stokes, the journalist who promoted this theory, was actually convicted of murdering Thomas Hamilton, who was a member of the group, which he claims was a setup after he'd been basically under a lot of police scrutiny. So there's a little bit of a conspiracy theory there that suggests that maybe...
He's got a motive.
The Angel of Death may have done Hamilton in, and it had been framed around Stokes doing it to get rid of a couple of difficult voices where obviously Hamilton was involved in the crime, might have been able to implicate O'Dempsey, and Stokes was quite vocal. And ever after he started publishing the articles, he did receive a lot of police attention. I think he was convicted on a drugs charge.
Well, they just try to find stuff to...
Try to find stuff to get rid of him.
So William Stokes, was he an author before he got tied up with these guys?
I think from what I can understand, author's probably a bit of a generous...
He had a story to tell.
He had a publication going, so he was an editor. He's listed as an editor and author. Just sounds like he probably just established his own little crime journal and ran with that.
But right.
Because of the harassment of the police, it was never able to get off the ground, and he claims it would have been a national publication by now.
Wow. Confident man.
So he's still alive and out there telling the story.
What about our mate Doug?
Doug Finchie. So he was. He also supports that this was part of a broader criminal enterprise. So after he was released and deported back to the UK, he confessed to his involvement again, reiterated that, but also did implicate the other people that had been named by Stokes as part of this whole version of events.
Is that well known by this time? Theory circulating?
Well, it was well known that it was circulating, but it was never followed up. And I suppose the probably crowning moment of it all was supposed to be at a current affair interview that Finch was going to give with Yana Wendt in 1988. And he was all set to spill his full knowledge and I suppose pull these guys into it. But Yana Wendt actually informed him that he was only convicted of one of the murders and that he could still be convicted of the other 14. And he quickly recanted his confession and burst into a bizarre rant about how he hadn't been feeling well and he doesn't know what he's saying and basically just tried to back out of it on TV. And I could not find that footage, but I'd love to see it.
So he does give the confession.
Gives the confession. Then she says he could still do more time, and he immediately pulls his confession and says that he's mentally ill. Writes a bizarre note to his estranged partner to basically try to further substantiate that he was mentally unwell at that point. So it's also known at that time that O'Dempsey was basically threatening him that if he stepped foot back in the country, he'd be killed. And he had put plans in place to make sure that if he did come back into the country, he would be killed so that he couldn't possibly implicate
him. What were those plans?
I can only imagine that they were very sophisticated. But look, he was a very bad criminal and he did manage to spend a lot of time out of confinement. So he obviously knew his way around a well-concealed murder, which I'm sure will be a hallmark of your episode on him, Stu.
Yeah, I feel like this is just selling my episode. Yeah.
We're going to cover all.
Are you happy for me to talk about the?
Yeah, absolutely.
So, but perhaps the most concrete evidence that we know that has actually seen the inquest reopened in 2017 into the Whiskey A Go-Go fire is very disturbing. So, unfortunately, the fire didn't claim the last deaths tied to this whole sordid affair, and O'Dempsey and Dubois actually kidnapped and murdered Billy McCulkin's wife and two young daughters after they started to talk a bit too openly about their knowledge of the crimes.
And this was about a year after the fires, A bit of time had passed, and I think it started to circulate that McCulkin's family knew a bit too much.
Mm.
And one night when Billy wasn't home, Billy the Mouse, Barbara?
Yeah, Barbara and McCulkin.
And the two daughters just vanished.
This sounds similar to what happened to Hamilton.
Mm. So we see some pretty devious lengths that Vincent O'Dempsey was happy to go to cover his tracks.
Pretty extreme lengths.
Mm. And they were finally convicted of those crimes in 2017. So
40 years after.
Yeah, only recently put behind bars for anything related to it. They have spent some time in jail in the interim, but this was the first time they've ever done anything tied to Whiskey A Go-Go, and therefore obviously a pretty concrete link established, and the inquest, I believe, is still open today.
An inquiry just reopened, hasn't it, Rev? And they actually want to try and get Finch back to give evidence.
Mm. So good luck with that. Can only imagine what he's up to now. He'd be about 70, he'd be late 70s. Correct. So I don't imagine he's lived a real clean life. So be very interesting to see how this one unfolds.
Yeah.
So
40 years between the conviction and the,
Whiskey
A Go-Go. I imagine that wasn't the last of O'Dempsey's nefarious deeds.
No, we're going to hear more about those in a future episode, but I suppose there's probably, I don't think there's a huge amount of room for conjecture on this one, but I'm wholly and solely sold on that theory that has been put forward there by Jeff Plunkett.
How's that changed the way you think about Stuart? Is he somewhat of a victim in this? I use that term very loosely.
I suppose he is in a sense, but I don't imagine it would have drastically changed his overall outcome.
Sure.
So he would have obviously done the same, had the same penalty, but I suppose if you consider that it's a bigger penalty to pay that you're seen as the only culprit, well, one of the only two culprits, then I suppose maybe he did get a slightly harsh rap, but realistically he would have done a life sentence anyway, so...
Yeah.
Do you think he would have done it to try and set up his own racket regardless, Robert?
No, I don't believe that part. I think that he was just hooked in to set it up for Billy McCulkin and Vincent O'Dempsey. I don't think he had I don't think he was a sophisticated enough criminal to be looking at those sort of things. He might have been an indirect beneficiary of the whole thing and maybe paid an amount, but I think that the strings were being pulled by O'Dempsey and McCalkin. And we do know that, obviously, Stewart was very close friends with McCalkin earlier in this story than just this, so it's not their first association. What do you guys think?
Yeah, he was definitely going down a bad road and a life of crime. Even if he didn't get dragged into the whiskey, the go-go stuff, then I'm sure it still would have ended up in the same place.
Yeah.
Maybe not dead, but in prison.
Yes.
Yeah, anything that I'm going to say is basically going to echo you guys. But what I have really dwelled on is how powerful is this underworld of the Fortitude Valley, King's Cross, New South Wales and Queensland. The amount of power that these guys have and fear that they've instilled in a lot of their foot soldiers, I think that's really intriguing and something I'd like to learn a bit more about.
Yeah,
and tie in with the authorities and law enforcement and politics as well, Stu. There's a lot going on there.
Yeah, the amount of corruption, I see it in movies and TV shows all the time, but this really makes it more of a real story for me.
Yeah, and this is, I think, where you sort of see, if you, all the things that we see documented well in Underbelly and I suppose some Australian drama on TV, this is very much the origin story, I suppose, this sort of stuff we're seeing here with police corruption just being able to go unchecked and the amount of money that was able to be established in organised crime through things like this. And, you know, Lenny McPherson is a big figure in those series, and these sort of guys, I'm sure probably if you went back and watched those now, having done this episode, you'd probably start to see some names you recognise. So, yeah, it is interesting. And we've managed to do all this without any scathing judgments on police, which probably indicates us maturing as a podcast. But obviously, I would probably again hint that where we see what we think is ineptitude, we're just seeing something maybe a bit more sinister play out in terms of the overall agenda.
I'd imagine you'd be out of breath, Reb, if you were as critical as you have been in the past with the police in this episode.
I think you're just numb to it now.
I'm just numb. If this was episode 6, we'd have to have a part 3 that was just more review of the police.
You'd be livid. The table would be flipped.
So all our listeners can be thankful that we've grown.
Oh, we have.
I'm glad we did this in 2 parts, though, because it was, Rev, when you started, it was going to be a 1-part episode. And the more we sort of found the different connections and different rabbit holes to explore, we realised how big this story really is.
Yes.
And I think that's been really, like, you've read a whole book on it, but there was more to the story than just that book gave you.
Absolutely. And hence, it will spin off a Vincent O'Dempsey podcast.
And potentially more. There's these characters, the Clockwork Orange Gang.
Yeah,
it's quite an interesting tale with those guys.
It is, absolutely.
Is it too early to reveal my episode? It's going to be solely on the mouse. History of the tattoo, how it all came to be.
Well, there's actually, if you really want to go into this deep dive, there's the guy who gave him the tattoo, Billy Phillips, has a strange story as well. So, yeah.
A couple of Billys. It
weaves around.
He could be back. So, exciting times, and we look forward to that, Stu.
We do. That'll be coming up in a couple of episodes' time, I believe. Episode 27.
It will be, yeah. Let's earmark it now and
stay tuned.
Look forward to it.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks very much, Rev. That was very well researched, in depth, and very well done.
Thank you. Thank you.
You've recovered well from your off shift.
Yeah, I think I like to think that I've shown my worth.
Absolutely.
Absolutely, Rev.
Speaking of showing your worth, what have you got for us next week, Tom?
I'm not going to let the cat out of the bag, but I have been doing a bit of work on the podcast, so I should be able to turn up next Monday and present something.
Excellent.
Should be no delays next week.
It's a very self-aware statement of you, Tom.
Yeah.
But leaving us in the dark.
Yeah.
Well, I guess I'm not meant to know anything about it. Is that what you're doing?
You're in the dark.
Yeah.
I will give a little tease in that is that we'll be dealing with some nice pieces of art on a very grand scale next week. So take
well, there that. You go. If anyone can figure out what that's going to be before it's published, then I'd love to hear from you. And that's actually a wonderful segue because we're into that point where we plug where we can hear.
Plug.
Yep. Nice piece of art on a grand scale.
So if you know what he's talking about, send us an email, feedingconfreaks@gmail.com. Where else can they find us, Tom?
Get us on Facebook, Fair Dinkum Freaks, Instagram, Fair Dinkum Freaks, Twitter, Fair Dinkum Freak, Stu. No S on Twitter.
Absolutely. You can listen to us on iTunes, Spotify, Castbox.
Castbox is a good one.
Another good one. Got a few subscribers on there. So, and make sure you recommend it to your friends. Awareness really helps us.
Absolutely. And give us a review on iTunes. That's always useful.
Yep.
We had some good interaction on social media last week, so we'd love to see some more of that. So thank you very much to all our listeners, and especially thank you if you've recommended it to your friends. And we will see you next week for a very mysterious episode from Tom.
Yes. Thank you to our listener in Ireland.
I've got one now
from Ireland.
Could be James Finch.
We're international. That's okay.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Finchy.